Welcome to the podcast of Ideas. My name is Ella Whelan and I'm joined today by the Academy of Ideas team. There's so much in the news at the moment and we thought as a bit of a New Year's resolution for 2024 that we would revive our office team podcasts and get together relatively regularly to discuss some of the key issues of the month, what's going on nationally, internationally, and everything that's happening in the world. So let me introduce us all today. We have with us on this call Claire Fox, Director of the Academy of Ideas, Alistair Donald, co-convener of the Battle of Ideas Festival, Rob Lyons, our Science and Technology Director, Mo Lovett, the National Coordinator of Debating Matters, Jeff Kidder, the Director of Memberships and Events at the Academy of Ideas, and Jacob Reynolds, an Associate Fellow of the Academy of Ideas. So, everyone, there's so much to go through, and it was really hard to pick what we were going to look at because obviously there is big scandals going on with the post office drama, a discussion about religious education in schools, but we can only do so much. So let's begin with looking at the big drama in Parliament this week, the Rwanda bill, or the rebellion that wasn't, as it's being called. A lot of promise that the Tories were going to split, that there was going to be huge sort of drama within the party. And in actual fact, the bill passed comfortably with only 11 voting against, lots of people quietly forgetting their backbone that they had so proudly boasted about only 24 hours previously. And actually today, we're recording this on Friday, news of Rishi Sunak giving a press conference, a kind of boosterish press conference, riding on the idea that he had won a victory and pressurising the Lords to get on with it quickly, saying that this was the will of the people. The Lords have come back and said, how dare you, not at all, we're going to take as long as we like and that's going to be 2 months. So we're not going to see much action in relation to this legislation becoming law very quickly, but there is a lot to talk about it. So Rob, your thoughts on what's going on with this Rwanda bill and immigration policy more generally?
Well, in terms of Rwanda, I think like a lot of people, the very concept of the scheme leaves me feeling a bit queasy, because Rwanda isn't exactly a bastion of human rights itself. Certainly, if you're the kind of person in Rwanda who's opposed to the regime, then it's you live a very sticky life, as it were. A regime that clamps down on opposition has been accused of bumping off its opponents, even if when they're abroad, came to power in perhaps both horrible and dubious circumstances. And certainly isn't the kind of good guys in Africa that they were being painted as sort of 20 years ago. Now there's a lot more criticism of that government. So there's that. Although in terms of, is it safe to be in Rwanda in general, it seems that they seem to have a very thriving tourist industry and probably make an all right life there. But in terms of sending people to Rwanda with no hope of ever achieving asylum status in the UK seems like both a dubious scheme and one that's turning out to be very, very expensive and very ineffective. And so the fact that Rishi Sunak, who had privately expressed concerns about the cost and effectiveness of this scheme as Chancellor, is now painted into the corner of having to keep pushing it just to be seen to be doing something about the small boats, is clearly not the best start for a policy. Nonetheless, people in the UK do want something to be done about immigration. I think in general, most people think that there is too much immigration, and they certainly don't like the idea of people coming to the UK illegally in the kind of numbers that we've seen over recent years. But on the one hand, we have the Tory rebels who collapsed very, very quickly, even though I think they had some reasonable points to make about whether this bill will actually achieve what it sets out to do. And on the other hand, the fact that the Lords will probably amend it to by 1,000 cuts into nothingness, as William Atkinson on CapEx today, making the point that they can't even override the Lords with this any amendments to the Lords in quite the same way they normally would, because it's the last session of Parliament and it wasn't in the manifesto. And so all the usual kind of ways you could bat away what the Lords might do to it are going to be very ineffective this time. So it's a very difficult situation, and I can't see that it's going to be the solution to Rishi Sunak's problems.
Mo?
Well, just, you know, on what Rob said there, I mean, he said essentially, you know, immigration is a big issue for people. But the irony of Rishi Sunak today calling it the will of the people. I mean, it's safe to say that not very many people are enthusiastic about this bill, even within the general public. You're either against the bill or, like some of the Tory rebels, you just don't think it was strong enough because it doesn't reduce some of the routes, for intervention and appeal via the European Court of Human Rights. So it seems to me that outside the Tories, there's little enthusiasm for the bill itself. And even within the Tories themselves, it's, I think the idea that they're pushing through with this is because they will look weak. This is the kind of last stand of Rishi Sunak. If he can't get this through, what kind of authority does he have as as the Prime Minister? But I think it's almost done the opposite in a sense, because we can all see the transparency of the process is there for us to see. They've actually come out looking weaker. I mean, even the sort of unveiling of the civil service overruling ministers when it came to Rule 39, that they're not allowed to do that. There was rumors that the government was going to have to reissue guidelines to the civil service, and in actual fact they did send a memo, I think, on Monday or slightly before Monday, saying, it is within the power of a minister to overrule Rule 39 of the ECHR. Civil servants must abide by that ruling. And it's just worth pointing out that there are other countries, France most recently, who have done that, and there hasn't been the pushback that there has against this government. So I think we're dealing with a bill that isn't fit for purpose. We're dealing with the Tories clinging on to this as a way to kind of clinging on to power. And we've got a whole raft of civil society, the civil service, and an opposition government who are going to, and indeed the House of Lords, now it's gone up to the House of Lords after the third reading, that are really against this bill. So it feels like it's not a victory at all, because it's just a potential step to a potential bill that potentially probably won't work.
Claire.
I thought it was interesting that there's reports from Davos that President Kagame from Rwanda is regretting ever signing up for this, because he might have been doing it to enhance the reputation of Rwanda and for the financial benefits that Rwanda would accrue. But he apparently is being lobbied by other African leaders and saying it's really bad for your profile that they've managed to turn this into a debate about whether Rwanda is, got a human rights record of any merit. It's now an international talking point that Rob started with, which is Rwanda that good after all? Might have rather backfired. And the rumor is that he's saying, take your money, wish I could get out of it. But anyway, that's one of life's ironies. The second contribution that just to make that I would add to what's been said already is that the point about the Lords. And we're waiting still for a date for the second reading when it comes to the Lords, is you'd think that there was no other legislation about to be discussed, because everywhere you go, there are caucuses of people from the Lords standing around talking about how they're going to stop this bill. I'm not part of that, even though I'm no supporter of the bill. But I wanted to reflect on the will of the people point that Rishi Sunak completely cynically used in his broadcast to the nation. Because it is undoubtedly true that it is the will of the people that a national sovereign government should be able to control its borders and make its own laws. And if those laws clash with international agreements, that the sovereign decision making of parliament should take precedence. That was very much the spirit of Brexit. The very specific issue of the Rwanda bill is just irrelevant. People. Even who are hard line, absolutely hard line on the small boats and/or immigration and on border control, are now not very enthusiastic about the Rwanda bill, because they can see that it's just not very likely to succeed at doing what Rishi Sunak has promised it will do. And I do think that this is a complete problem for democracy, which is that the government has chosen to interpret the desire to control borders, chosen to interpret the cynicism that's rightly attached to the asylum process, which the government has made such a mess of with these massive breaches of security, huge long waiting lists costing a fortune, people staying in hotels, has exploited that with one very narrow solution, which is the Rwanda scheme, which is at best maybe might work. It's completely illiberal, but that's not the point. It's just he has literally put all his eggs in this one boat, and it's just ridiculous. that he's done that because it's not going to be effective. But he thinks that, and this is where I do agree with my opposition in the Lords, it is a bit like throwing meat to the red wall as they understand it in exactly that insulting term, which is they think if we solve this problem, the red wall might vote for us because they think that the red wall voters are idiots. Whereas red wall voters are very clear that they want the issue of illegal migration sorting out and the disingenuous discussion about increasing legal migration, tackling and sorting as well, and being brought to the public's attention. What they don't necessarily want is some scheme that's going to spend the whole time getting tangled up in the law courts, which nobody thinks is going to work. And I do feel finally that although I last thing I want to do is be seen to defending the Lords because they will drive me mad and I'll end up supporting the bloody bill just because I'll be annoying at all the opposition saying we can't breach international law, etc., etc. That Rishi Sunak, when he says the will of the people versus the Lords and so on, it's almost as though he's setting up himself for failure and is ready to blame the Lords for the problems with this bill when the problem is the bill, not the Lords. The problem of the Lords is something that should be tackled, but this is not the key problem. But you just tell he just wants a scapegoat, and the HRC or the Lords will do.
Well, call me a cynic. I'm feeling increasingly more like this is a project that the government knew wasn't going to work and was going to, and it's now looking for a sort of to use it as a means of saying, well, we tried, but it's out of our hands. Because, you know, the whole issue of making an immigration system work in this country is based on a very big and fraught and important ideological battle over the ECHR and the whole question of Brexit and controlling borders, which, as we know, through his appointment of David Cameron recently and the sort of gear shift towards a much more sort of softly, softly liberal approach to foreign policy and immigration and all the rest of it that came with that, that Rishi Sunak and this government is not up for a fight with international law courts. It doesn't want to go there. And it also doesn't want to do the sort of basic hard work of just simply implementing centres. You know, they've ridiculous. They're doing things like, you know, spending loads of money on sort of diseased boats rather than actually putting in place basic system of processing and things like that that you would need long-term planning to make an immigration system work. So it's I feel extremely cynical about it. I think that no, I'm not convinced that anyone thought this was going to work from the start. And I actually think it's a bit of a scandal that it's being used to use this sort of big announcement, big attempt by the government to do something when everybody can see how vacuous it is. Okay, well, let's move more internationally now and talk about recent events in the conflict in Israel and Gaza. On recording, today has been 104 days since the 7th of October attacks by Hamas. Hostages are still missing, and a lot has happened. Focus in the last week or so has been in Yemen with the UK and the US leading strikes against the Houthis. And in the last few days, sort of international discussion about Benjamin Netanyahu's rejection of the two-state solution, which isn't really news to anyone, it seems, but certainly strong words from him saying, we will not settle for anything short of an absolute victory. The US putting more pressure on him to soften. And, you know, there, as we know with, for example, what happened in Ukraine and Russia, people get war weary. The initial sort of, unfortunately, the initial outrage, small as it was internationally about the pogrom on the 7th of October, has sort of weakened even still. And there's increasing pressure to criticize Israel to stop what's going on in Gaza. A mess is certainly a light way of putting it. But Jacob, your thoughts on what's been going on?
Well, you've covered the news stories quite well, but I think it's important to take a little bit of a step back and try and understand what has kind of come into view and has crystallized over recent weeks and months. And I think this is important for people to do, even if they might have serious concerns or maybe might even be completely outraged about the way that Israel has conducted the war in Gaza. And I think what's kind of coming into view, especially in the reactions to what goes on, especially in the West, but not just in the West, is that you can almost see coming into view, something that you might call a kind of a new third worldism, or at the very least, a kind of generalized anti-Westernism is coming into view. And this was to some degree visible in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and Putin and Lavrov, or especially Lavrov going off and courting all of these kind of African countries and saying, we're leading this new anti-Western decolonial crusade. It became clear in the response of lots of people in Western countries to the October 7th massacre. But as I think become most clear in the wake of the military action against the Houthis, who, as we know, have been disrupting global shipping. And the thing that really kind of brought it into focus for me was seeing demonstrations in New York and to some degree in London in support of the Houthis. And we don't need to go into kind of detail about kind of what form of government and kind of what gets practiced by the Houthis, and all, everyone will be well familiar with it. But what we kind of see, I think, is a pretty unholy alliance of Western kind of decolonialist or decolonization types and an increasingly kind of virulent extreme form of Islamism. And there was the one thing that illustrated this nicely. There was a video that someone was doing of London protesters on the latest kind of pro-Palestine, kind of somewhat pro-Houthi march. And both kind of blue-haired leftist types and veiled Muslim women were both like saying, were both asked the questions in different clips of this video, like, well, what do you mean when you say you're against Zionism? And they all answered kind of uniformly that we're against like Western global capitalism, we're against the West, we're against capitalism, or we're against global Westernism, or something like something, some combination of those words, which made it kind of clear that what was coming into view is, as I say, a kind of anti-Westernism. And I mean, in a way, both the decolonialist types that are reared in the universities in the UK and also Islamists share what you the kind of like neo-medieval attitude, a very hostile reaction to the values that constitute the Enlightenment that kind of we consider to be the basis of Western civilization. And so you get this kind of glorification of violence for its own sake. You get this increasingly kind of medieval sense of a politics of good versus evil. And so I think that what's coming into view, regardless, as I say, of how you think Israel is conducting the war or anything like that, what's becoming really worrying to me is the reaction that you see and the this unholy alliance of these two people who really should have nothing to do with each other, but they both share this kind of anti-Western impulse. And I think, I mean, it's not, of course, that the West has much to say, or if you were to look at kind of Western leaders, that you'd think the West has much going for it at the moment. Biden's quote when asked about the strikes on the Houthis was kind of really enlightening in a way, where he said, "Oh, it's not working, but we're going to carry on." It was like he just didn't really know what to do, and it kind of symbolized what was going on. But it's almost as if this kind of internal crisis of Western society and of Western elites, this crisis of self-confidence, has acquired almost like a nightmare coming to life, has acquired a kind of external dimension in both the Houthis or Hamas, and then also kind of internally in these kind of decolonialist types that I've been talking about, who are out there protesting in favor of Hamas.
Alistair?
Yes, I think the situation that Jacob describes is most evident in the spread of the war throughout various different countries over the past week. I mean, it's not just been Yemen, but there's been Iran launching missiles into the Pakistan and Pakistan launching them back. There's been Syria and Iraq that have been recipients of Iranian missiles as well. So it does, as well as the situation in the Red Sea, so this does have very much a feeling of a situation that's slipping out of control. And I suppose it was epitomized by another Joe Biden response this week when he was asked where it's going, and he said, "I don't know." It's just the sense of is anybody in control of this, and does anyone have a real sense of what it is that they're trying to achieve? Because it doesn't seem to be the case that any of them really know where they want to go with this. I mean, Israel has fairly firmly rebutted the American request to rein back on the war. And said, we're going to continue and we're going to achieve our war aims to destroy Hamas and to effectively take control of the entire area of Israel, including Gaza. So they seem to be fairly firm on that, although you suspect that even the Israelis don't particularly know what it is that they want to achieve in the long term. But the West seems even more to lack any sort of impetus and an inability to exercise any sort of control in the region. And, you know, we've already seen the situation in terms of what's happened in Russia and the surrounding countries to Russia, which are in a broadly speaking, in a state of collapse and interstrife between countries. That seems to be the future of the Middle East. I think just one additional point. I think it's been very interesting to Jacob mentioned some of the protests and what's been going on in the West and on the streets of London and other cities in the UK. But I think it's important that we also look beyond those people who choose to go on marches, because some people might have seen the situation that's come to light this week in the training session that was done for all the civil service people and government advisors from the Home Office and the Foreign Office and other departments, where allegations have been made that the academics delivering that course were basically saying, what is a terrorist? What's the difference between a terrorist and a freedom fighter? And unable to really hold the line in any way in terms of understanding the West's role and the threat posed by terrorism. Now, these are allegations at the moment, and a very serious allegation is that one of the academics talked about the need to suppress the views of people like Joe Rogan and Douglas Murray and other commentators who they perceive as being problematically right-wing. But it really does illustrate the whole situation at King's College, just how much it is the elite and the representatives of the elite through institutions like the civil service and through Western academics that really the infusion of identity politics and identitarian thinking into these sections of society really is serving to undermine any ability to get to grips, at least intellectually, with what's going on.
Jeff?
A lot of the points have been made, but the general instability across quite a few regions, in fact, is very notable in the last few weeks. The fact that the Taliban put out a statement yesterday calling for Iran, Pakistan to show restraint and basically trying to be the diplomats in the scene is a sign of how unstable and peculiar the situation is. And also the fact that the Houthis attacks are attacks on shipping. It's not like it's a war situation or a traditional conflict against the Western world. And yet many people in the West see themselves as siding with these people who are sort of latter-day pirates or something of that ilk, and they sort of identify with them as opposed with people who are presumably for them are just doing trade, i.e. taking stuff from one food and goods from one part of the world to another, which is a fairly innocent occupation. I just wanted to say something separate about the casual anti-Semitism, and particularly what happened in relation to sport, which is casual and widespread around the world. And part of the third worldist side of things which has been discussed is the South Africa's court case in The Hague against Israel. But the disgraceful side of what's happened in South Africa domestically is the removal of the captain of the South African under-19 cricket team, ostensibly because there was the under-19 Cricket World Cup, which is just starting at the moment, ostensibly because there were going to be protests because the captain was a Jewish person who had expressed support for Israel. Although there's obviously lots of debate about what the real motivations were. But basically, he has been removed as the captain for the tournament because he provoked a reaction because of things he'd done. And the inability of South Africa to hold the line on that is really disgraceful. And it has echoes of the Basil D'Oliveira affair in the 1960s, where England picked a person of colour, as was defined in the time by South Africa, to go on a tour of South Africa. And England, to its credit, when South Africa said this guy can't join the tour because we're an apartheid state, England withdrew. And it was a very big and positive thing. Whereas now, this current case of the of a Jewish captain of South African under 19 team has been largely swept under the carpet, and there's been no. There were some small protests in South Africa, but it hasn't had the effect it would have. It's just a casual thing that's happened. In the last week, two Israeli footballers have had to leave their Turkish clubs because they expressed solidarity with the hostages in held by Hamas, which is considered a very bad thing in Turkey. And Israel has just announced that they're going to the Olympics and the opening ceremony of the Olympics, which again is causing a whole new debate about, oh, Israel's going to the Olympics, as if Israel is this pariah state and not a normal state. So this whole debate around Jewish people, around anti-Semitism, is spreading in many what should be recreational and entertainment world like this in a very casual way, which for me is very disturbing.
Yeah, well, lots of people are saying that, you know, the fact that the South African government has decided to do this is a sort of, you know, as a means to sort of domestically take attention away from the fact that it's in a sort of ruinous state and an absolute basket case, and its own citizens are extremely angry, to try and point the finger elsewhere. And there has been quite a lot of nerve-wracking, you know, posturing statements made by political leaders or people in positions of political power over the last few weeks. We had, you know, Grant Shapps, who somehow has found himself in quite a, you know, significant position of international political power, making statements about how we were sort of going into forever wars, that we only had 5 years for things to start kicking up, and really sort of posturing. And in the last sort of 48 hours, NATO heads coming out and telling people to sort of stockpile toilet roll and buy batteries for their torchlights and be prepared for war with Russia in 20 years or someone else even sooner. And, you know, obviously we're in a position in which things are so volatile, things are so fraught, that I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with saying that actually the international sort of world order geopolitics is in an unpredictable state. But there's sort of the level of international diplomacy and the sort of the rules that used to apply for what political leaders said publicly seems to have gone out the window, and that has real serious ramifications for igniting conflicts where they might not necessarily have happened. But Claire, any of your thoughts?
I just wanted to note in the interesting example that Jeff raised about the under 19 cricket captain, that the excuse of safety is one which any of us who've been following the campus cancellations is familiar with, which is that they say, oh, we had to get rid of you because there was protesters and they would make the whole thing unsafe. And all I'm saying is we're familiar with that as a tactic for closing things down and cancelling people. So it's been interesting watching that. I wanted to mainly note, following on from Jacob's points about kind of this peculiar combination of Western liberals adopting a kind of third worldism and outlook, that something very peculiar has happened, which is you are now in a situation where there really is a genuine problem about ascertaining what happens, what the truth is, what's the difference between mis and disinformation and reality and so on. Because I have seen in all of the kind of interviews that have been done, in all of the discussions, the default position in the West amongst radicals, progressives, but in a way amongst the majority, particularly of young people, is that we should believe Hamas and the Houthis and their supporters. And you shouldn't believe anything that anyone says from a Western government or certainly from Israel. It's just assumed that they're all lies. And it makes a conversation really difficult. It's constantly said now that the events on October the 7th are exaggerated by Israel, that a lot of the terrible horrors and terror did not occur. This is just asserted as though it's fine to say. The figures in terms of casualties are constantly driven by what Hamas has said. And that's a kind of very disconcerting challenge to those of us who want to have open discussion and debate, because you are talking to people who just, by the very nature, deny reality. And we have a, and we'll just assume, I mean, people keep saying I'm a Zionist shill as a consequence of trying to say the evidence shows this. We have had a bit of a breakthrough, which is The Guardian, I think, today on this Friday, has just announced that it's decided that there were rapes occurring on October the 7th. They've decided the evidence is there. I mean, you know, months afterwards, they have now conceded that. But that was after actually a huge amount of denial. And as they've done it, they've then been accused of falling under pressure from Israel and Zionism. That's what social media people are saying. Why is the Guardian given in to the bullies in Israel conceding that this was these sex crimes actually happened when they were just part of the propaganda machine against Hamas? And it does mean that you have a situation where the people interviewed on demonstrations, Western people, will now say, I support Hamas and the Houthis and would join them, and they're legitimate. And they'll quote all those old, you know, one man's terrorist, another man's freedom fighter, with, and then asked if they can define what an intifada is. They haven't got a clue. So it's a completely kind of ignorant pulling out of a meme rather than the deep philosophical thought that went into actually in the past those kind of oppositional ideas. But final point, I don't want to let those people who are pro-Israel off the hook. Israel itself, it seems to me, are getting quite desperate because they feel they're losing the propaganda war. And sometimes the way they talk about what's happening in Gaza is very difficult. And the second thing is, you know, we should be acknowledge that, is that a well-known and renowned Palestinian artist just had her show cancelled by an American university because she's a Palestinian who supports Palestinian self-determination. And the university cancelled the show. She's an alumni and former professor of that university. And I think that it is an obligation of those of us who are pro-free speech that we are not one-sided about this. You know, if cancel culture is being used in an anti-Semitic way, in some instances, to silence and terrorize visiting Israelis into the West or Jewish students in the UK or what have you, it doesn't mean that you should go along and cancel Palestinian supporters either. You have to be very careful about where that leads.
Well, finally then, a report commissioned by the Police and Crime Commissioner for Greater Manchester into the what's been happening in Rochdale with grooming gangs, news that has been out for a very long time, has quite conclusively found evidence of not only widespread and organised sexual exploitation of children in Rochdale from 2004, but also, and very significantly, failures by Greater Manchester Police and the Council Children's Services. Police were made aware of potential victims numbering 127 back in 2012, but did not act, so knew what was going on, but decided not to act. And we know from this being covered in, you know, the press, in some newspapers, and for some time, that there has been this controversy around the issue, the fact that the men were, who were perpetrators of the acts, were mainly Pakistani, the girls who were the victims were mainly white and British. There have been some convictions, but this is certainly not a solved issue, and there are girls who are still coming forward, and there are still things being uncovered. But to take it, sort of the issue is not just a legal one or one of sort of criminal actions. I think for many people, it is symbolic of a sense that things don't work, that social services don't work, that the police aren't doing their job, that injustices to certain sections of society, predominantly in this case white working class girls, are ignored for various reasons. So Mo, you've read the report and been following this. What have you been thinking about it?
Yeah, so I would actually recommend if people want to go and read the report. It's not actually as long or as as technically legalistic as I imagined it would be, but in a sense that's its failing. So there are, I think it's interesting what the report does say and also what it doesn't say. So as you said in your introduction there, Ella, Greater Manchester Police had been aware of the issue of on-street grooming of vulnerable children. They were also aware of the profile of the offenders since way back as 2004, but they'd failed to address these crimes. They'd failed to instigate any kind of covert operations because they said, quote, in the report, that they were only to be used for serious crimes such as firearm possessions and drug dealing, but not apparently the sexual exploitation of children. It does say, you know, in the report that Greater Manchester Police had repeatedly ignored well-evidenced allegations from victims, but they've been deemed unreliable. These young girls were deemed as unreliable witnesses. But actually, we know from a lot of the newspaper coverage, from things the whistleblowers such as Maggie Oliver and Sarah Rowbotham have said, that that doesn't even cut to the heart of it. I mean, Maggie Oliver says she was told by a senior colleague when she was investigating it that these children would contribute nothing to society and it'd been better if they'd been drowned at birth. I mean, I say that because I mean, I know it's one person's account of what happened. However, I say that because the deep level of prejudice against these children because of their background and their social position is quite intolerable, really. And the fact that, you know, one of the victims has just said that her perpetrator, the person that abused her, has just moved around the corner. So we know that there are still people who've been sexually abusing children kind of out on the streets in Rotherham. So I do think, and you mentioned as well in your introduction about the profile of the perpetrators. And the report doesn't go into that at all. So you can have the Deputy Mayor of Manchester saying, Kate Green, saying that there's no evidence about the perpetrators. But just because it wasn't in the report doesn't mean we're not aware of that. And given that we live in an era of virtue signalling where people are very feminist, are very clear to come out about, you know, women as victims, girls as victims, and you know, to show their credentials at opposing racism, we see none of that from the usual suspects on this issue. It's just deemed something that they want to stay away from.
I actually think that it's very good news that the report came out. It's very good news that it had a fair amount of profile and that people in the political class have been forced to acknowledge that this was a major scandal. I think what's really distressing, though, is that it was kind of one day of media coverage. And as I think Mo's illustrated really well, it was evasive as a report about a number of important sides to the issue, which were the most controversial. The fact that the young women were not treated equally to those who claimed to be victims of Me Too offences in Westminster because they were the wrong type of victims, that the perpetrators explicitly described them as white trash, and that there was a racial element to this, and that we know that the reason why a lot of the political voices in the local area refused to get involved in this was because they were fearful that they would be called Islamophobic and racist because the perpetrators were by and large Pakistani Muslim men. And, you know, the fact that that's still a kind of thing you can't say is problematic. And in the earlier discussion, when we were talking about the problems around migration, illegal migration, and so on, one of the things that we have to acknowledge, those of us who were perfectly liberal about migration, have to acknowledge that the disastrous impact of people living parallel lives and state-sanctioned multiculturalism has been that it's allowed a form of identity politics to emerge where people are actually not integrating into British society at all. And that people who are British, and I do not mean white, I mean British citizens, are frightened of having open conversations about certain topics. And this is one of them. So good that the report's out there, but this is still a scandal that hasn't received enough attention, in my opinion.
As you said, not very much covered in the time since after initial bursts. And I do think that Charlie Peters of GB News does deserve a mention for keeping this subject in focus and in the public eye in his reporting for many of these towns in the north of England. Often derided as a news channel, but you have to say that they have very much kept this in the news, and I think deserve a mention just for that. For me, the very striking thing about what happened the other day was the contrast between the very angry but very eloquent campaigners and people who have struggled for years and years and years to bring this into the public eye, Maggie Oliver and Sarah Rowbotham, and the representatives of public service, directly, I suppose, at the press conference, the Chief Constable of Greater Manchester Police, who gave a very perfunctory statement as far as I could see. And it just does really raise the question about what public servants do and what they see their duties as, because as people have said so far, there was so much of this that was reported to the police and reported to various different council authorities, and nothing was done about it. And what is the duty of a public servant if it's not to act on this type of information and these very, very serious stomach-churning accusations, really, as come out in the report this over the last week? So I just think it's really, really noticeable that you can have any amount of bureaucratic procedures and safeguarding processes and no doubt many, many, many boxes to tick in the way that they try to deal with all these types of issues. But unless you actively have a public servant that sees something of duty in the act of public service, then nothing will happen, because it will become a formulaic process of tick-boxing, making it as easy as possible to get by. As we've heard from the report, people not even speaking to the people that were conducting a review, because it becomes easier just to keep quiet rather than have to face the music and these things. So that, to me, is the most stunning thing about this whole thing, is just how the dereliction of public duty.
Well, as well as, you know, questions about how the police work, how the social services work, I think, Mo, you touched on the fact that of the sort of official, in as much as it exists, official feminist response to it, in terms of how much media attention it was given by the sort of usual suspects who would talk about these issues at the drop of the hat. And Claire, you mentioned Pestminster. If we can rewind the clock back and remember that prolonged period of British political life, which was a huge national and actually at some points international discussion about how misogynistic and sort of chronically institutionally sexist the British political system was, which boiled down to an accusation or two of sort of knee grazing and touches under tablecloth at fancy dinners and things like that. So extremely, in the grand scheme of things, low level accusations of sexual harassment, which took up the entirety of the British commentariat's attention. And this was happening at the same time that news was dripping out about the girls in Rochdale and Rotherham. And there were people like Julie Bindle and other writers who have doggedly from the start been commenting about this, but they just weren't given the spots on primetime television that people who were talking about Pestminster were. And there was no interest in it. And I mean, looking at that comparison, you have to then start thinking about what we were just talking about in relation to the rape accusations, you know, made against Hamas, the obvious evidence that anyone could see from the start that Hamas had weaponized rape and brutalized women as a means of waging war on Israel. And the response to that, not just ignorance of it and not just sort of turning a blind eye to it, but outright denial. You have to ask the question, are there right victims and wrong victims? Are there right women and wrong women? It seems that the sort of vocal, middle class, good operator kind of feminist commentators who are able to get attention for their Me Too accusations do very well. But young women and children at the time, people who have now grown up to be women, who are ignored because they're poor and don't have a voice, and also women who come from a country that everyone seems to hate, Israel, are ignored in death and in brutality of rape because they have committed the sin of being from Israel. So I think there has to be some real soul searching within not, you know, feminists, but also organizations, women's organizations, who have failed on both accounts to make any kind of, you know, endlessly talk about violence against women and doing this or that and have this campaign, you know, whether it's UN Women or national organizations we have in this country, who have really failed in this and I think should be judged in the future for their response or lack of response to this. So thanks to everyone for that. We hope to do these more regularly. We hope that you subscribe to our Substack, hit the green button below this podcast, tell us your thoughts. You can always make comments. And if you become a paid subscriber, you get a whole load of bonuses, letters on liberty, access to information about our upcoming events, the Battle of Ideas Festival. There's a lot happening in 2024. It's a year of elections and lots of political things to discuss. So come along with us and we'll see you very soon.